From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley. Today, actor and singer Kate Hudson. She earned an Oscar nomination more than 20 years ago for Almost Famous. Now she's nominated again for Song Sung Blue, where she plays a Neil Diamond tribute performer. The role drew on her own late-blooming music career, and she also shares how her latest Oscar nomination brought her even closer to her mother, Goldie Hawn.
I look at this Oscar nomination, and I look at my mother, and it's an absolute extension of my mother. There's this amazing connection that I get to have with my mom at this time. She's 80, I'm 46. Like, how lucky am I that I get to really share that experience with her in that way?
We also talk about Hudson's release of her debut album, Glorious, more than two decades into her acting career. Touching hands. First News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley, and today my guest is Kate Hudson. She's up for an Oscar for her role as Claire in the film Song Sung Blue, starring opposite Hugh Jackman as one half of Lightning and Thunder, a Neil Diamond tribute band. Here they are together, singing Neil Diamond's 1971 hit, Solomon. If folks could see, you just started singing as you were listening to yourself.
Oh, it's such a joyous song.
Yeah, yeah. Kate Hudson landed the role of Claire Sardina after Hugh Jackman first saw her sing on CBS Sunday Morning. He had already committed to the movie, and he was so taken by her performance that he texted director Craig Brewer and said, "I think I just found your Claire." She was on TV promoting her debut album, Glorious, which she began writing during the pandemic. And while Hudson is primarily known for her acting, as I was preparing for this interview, I was struck by just how often she's used her voice over the years, singing on screen in Nine, performing cinema Italiano, and on television in Glee, where she played the demanding dance instructor, Cassandra July. This latest Oscar nomination for Best Actress comes 25 years after she first earned a nod for playing Penny Lane in Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous. From there, she became one of the most recognizable romantic comedy stars in the 2000s, starring in films like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days and Bride Wars. Most recently, she starred in the Knives Out sequel Glass Onion and the Netflix series Running Point, about a woman who inherits ownership of a professional basketball team. The show has been picked up for a second season. And Kate Hudson, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your Oscar nomination.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I look forward to our conversation.
Yes, well, I just had a chance to look at this Oscar nomination luncheon.
Yes.
Where all of you all are on bleachers and it's like a class photo. It's almost like a graduation.
It is. I remember it the first time. It's actually one of my favorite experiences because I remember the first time feeling like, oh, you know, we all got to be in one room and it's really just a bunch of people who love to make movies. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, there's not a lot of other people there. It's just sort of celebrating this class, this year of movies. And when you're a part of that, it's really fun. It feels really nice.
You mentioned the first time. It was in 2001 mm-hmm. where you were nominated for your role as Penny Lane in Almost Famous. I put both of those photographs side by side when I saw this most recent photograph. I mean, you're ravishing in this red outfit and you're smiling ear to ear. You have that same energy from 25 years ago, but there's sort of a pensiveness there in you. You know, you're the young kid on the block at that time. How did it feel with that 25-year separation, being in that room and really sitting with the fact that you're there again?
Well, it feels different. I've been comparing it to like having my third baby. You soak in everything very differently. You take it in differently. And you have so much knowledge. I mean, that was one of the great things about the Oscar nomination luncheon was I've worked with two of those costume designers. I've worked with so many people in the room. You look around, so many producers.
Like a reunion almost.
Yeah, the person that was in front of me is Dee Dee. She was the executive on How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Like, you realize that you create a family that in this industry, it's a... And like in family, you see all of it. You see the good, you see the bad, you see the ugly. And it's an amazing, incredible, dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while, you get to celebrate the best of the best of the year.
Well, let's get into the role that you have been nominated for. Your character, Claire Sardina, she's a real person, a hairdresser from Milwaukee who performs as a Patsy Cline impersonator by night. And she and her husband, Mike, create a Neil Diamond tribute band called Lightning and Thunder. They're everyday people with real battles. We watch them as they recognize that within themselves and each other. And in this scene I want to play, the two of you are on a date. It's before you're married, and you're sharing your hopes and dreams. Let's listen.
I'm always going to be an alcoholic, but I've been sober 20 years. And the other day was, well, they call it a sober birthday.
Happy belated sober birthday.
Here's the thing. With sobriety, yeah, you got to face up to certain truths.
Way to go, Lightning. 20 years.
All right, I'm not a songwriter. I'm not a sex symbol, but I just want to entertain people, and I want to make a living.
I know, me too. I don't want to be a hairdresser. I want to sing. I want to dance. I want a house. I want a garden. I want a cat.
So here's what I'm thinking. I need a hook. I need something big. I need something new. And as you put it, nostalgia pays.
That was my guest, Kate Hudson, with Hugh Jackman in the film Song Sung Blue. What was it about Claire's arc that you felt you understood?
Well, I think part of what's fun about what we get to do is that there's some things we don't understand, and we have to delve into it and try to portray something that seems further away from your real life than maybe other people would think. It's like there's not much about Claire's life that I really would personally be able to understand. The one thing that I do understand about Claire is her longing for love and family, her strong desire for community, and her love of music and her love of singing and performing. Everything else became about honoring her story and really trying to, you know, portray that as successfully as I could and respectfully.
She has ups and downs, but I mean, she really, there's a moment where she actually loses her leg. Mm-hmm. And so you had to learn how to kind of move even your body with the idea of wearing a prosthetic. She deals with depression, ups mm-hmm. and downs, all of those things as well.
Addiction
as well. Mm-hmm. You chose not to meet with the real Claire, and I wondered, is there something that gets in the way of being able to explore those parts of her by not meeting her?
I chose not to research her personally, mm-hmm. right? So I have met Claire, and I've spent time with Claire, and she's amazing, and I love her, and it was great. So when we started filming, I did spend some time with her. But in the beginning, it was important for me and for Craig that, you know, Craig's story. You know,
Craig Brewer, the director,
yeah. we're making this film that is a adaptation of the documentary. And he took 8 years of their life, consolidated into two. And my job as an actor is to give Craig the movie he wants. His relationship to Claire and the family is the intimate one. And for me, I think it would distract me from being able to give Craig what he needed. You know, I didn't want to challenge him because I'd spent so much time with Claire. I want to trust my director and what his vision is for his version of their life story. And then Claire sort of came to set, and then we got to meet each other and hang out, and I'd already done all of the work, you know. And getting to know Claire after that became the validation that we were...
That you were on the right
on
track.
On the right track, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's the part that's so fascinating to me. You know, I did ask you the question, what was it about the character that really drew you in, that you found, that really spoke to you? But what were the challenges of the character itself that drew you to her, that made you say, I want to live in this space, in this world, and be this person for what she draws out in the story?
I mean, I think women... When you read a lot of scripts and you read a lot of the types of characters that are written for women, very rarely do you see ones that hit all the notes, mm-hmm. right? So you can see things that are down the line. You can see what someone just sort of said to me, which I thought was a great way of putting it. They call it trauma porn. You know, you can see things where it's like, okay, we're going to lean into the complication of women and we're going to hit it as hard as possible. Mm-hmm. And then you see things that are the opposite. They're bright and they sort of lack
depth and complication because they're seen as being like comedic or funny or
one-dimensional.
Thank you. And very rarely do you see all of them in one. Mm-hmm. For women. When I see something like this, it's like, it's not only just what drew me to it, it's that they're not around like that much.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I got to play the comedy, some sense of humor. I got to play the love, the love story, the desire. I got to play being a mother and then I got to go into a place of where my life force is taken out of me, you know, and what that complication is as a mother to not want to be present or exist or live, to be under the throes of addiction and living with intense shame and then trying to fight your way out of it. It's like very, very rare. So everything attracted me to that project. The scary thing is that then you risk, because this movie isn't one-dimensional, it doesn't hit you over the head with one thing, it has to walk a line. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of movies are so hard to execute because they risk being too earnest or too sentimental, or they risk not being truthful enough in mm-hmm. stories of addiction or depression. How do you make a entertaining, life-affirming story about such an intense struggle of someone's life? So when you can hit the sweet spot, these are the types of movies I think that live forever.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kate Hudson. She's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress for her role in Song Sung Blue, where she plays Claire Sardina, one half of a real-life Neil Diamond tribute act in Milwaukee. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and today I'm talking to actress, singer, author, and entrepreneur Kate Hudson about her Oscar-nominated performance in Song Sung Blue and her debut album, Glorious. You know, Kate, in the intro, I mentioned that Hugh Jackman saw you singing on CBS Sunday Morning, and I know you taking on this role, the story is much more complicated than that, but the fact that he saw you and then text it to Craig Brewer, the director, "I think I just found your Claire." Had anyone in the industry ever chosen you for your voice before that moment?
You know, I think Hugh, it wasn't about my voice as much as it is about what I was talking about. And what I was saying was talking about why I had to make an album. And Hugh, to speak for Hugh, you know, he would reiterate, when he saw it, I was talking about my kids. I was talking about COVID and what happened when I was sort of reflecting on if I was going to die. Am I happy with my creative output? Mm. I'm very happy with myself as a mother. Like, I feel like I've made all the right mistakes and all the wrong mistakes. I feel like I've been really great when it comes to parenting.
I'll tell you, Kate, it's so refreshing to meet a woman who says that, because don't we so often, like, we're always stopping for a moment to say, I'm not sure if I was a great mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I like who my kids are. And so as I get to know them, I got one, an adult, as I get to know him as his own man and as an adult, I'm really proud of myself for the work I put in for him. And I am in it with my teenager right now in the best possible way. And my young girl, 7, like, momming is everything to me. And I'm proud of that output.
Like, I put a lot into that. And so I could say, you know, during COVID, if this was it, I felt confident in what I've given my kids so far. But I couldn't say that about my art. Mm. And that would be my own personal sadness and regret, is that I didn't share my writings as a musician. Whether people like them or not, I just really was not happy with the fact that I wasn't brave enough to put it out there.
What had been holding you back prior to COVID when you wrote Glorious and the funny story about how the album came together? But prior to that, what had been the thing holding you back?
Oh, so many things. There's so many aspects to this. I mean, number one, I became pretty famous pretty young. And at that time, you didn't do both. That time, if I told everybody I was going to go make an album, everybody would be scared. If it wasn't a success, it could have been the end of my career. Mm. It's like, don't break what's not broken. I was very happy. I met my husband at the time, my ex-husband, Chris. He's a rock star. You know what? I'll stay in my lane. I lived music with him. I got my, you know, he was incredibly supportive of mine and always wanted me to sing. We even did little shows where we sang together, but I was comfortable. So it just sort of kept taking back seats all the time. And then all of a sudden I was in my late 20s and I was in my early 30s and I'm in my late 30s. And I'm like, this isn't coming to me. Mm. Like, I'm either going to have to make this happen and be courageous enough to make the leap, or it's not going to happen. And then I'm going to regret it. And that's what happened in COVID. And
COVID is such an interesting time because it is the moment where so many of us, the quiet almost made all of those voices inside of us louder.
Yeah, quiet's good.
That story, though, about how you came to the album, singer-songwriter or songwriter Linda Perry saw you singing Katy Perry's Firework at a school fundraiser over Zoom.
Yeah.
Tell us that story. So she saw that and she said, wait a minute.
Yeah, she cold called me and she was like, what the? Mm. And I was like, I didn't know you sang like that. And I was like, well, I love to sing. At the time, I'd already done the thing in lockdown where I was like, I'm just going to say yes to everything.
Oh.
If someone asked me to sing, I'm going to say yes. I'm not going to be scared of it. I'm just going to say yes.
Because you had been asked before.
All the time. Oh, my God. All the time. Whether it be for a charity event or for a telethon or for an award show, even Broadway. So many amazing people that I love so much and so many directors and people have come to me and like, come on, come on. And I've always been like, oh, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. Or, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to say, you know, because I didn't have the, like, it's like being thrown into the fire, right? You're sort of like, it's not like I'm in a little club or something singing. It's like, you know, all of a sudden I'm in front on a television show in front of millions of people singing. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready for that.
What is the difference between singing versus acting and being in front of millions of people?
Well, no, you have to understand, for me, music is about my writing. I'm not a performing recording artist. So even though I would love to have probably been and done that, for me, if I was to do music, I didn't want it to be like someone else's music, right? And I always believed that if I was going to do it, I had to do it properly, like organically. I wanted to make an album. I wanted it to be mine. And music for me, I didn't want it to be like someone else's. I've been doing that my whole career with acting. So I felt like if I'm going to do it, I have to focus on it. I have to take the time. I have to give it the respect that music deserves and write it myself.
I would actually play the title track of your 2024 album, Glorious, and legend has it that you wrote the song first off in 10 minutes.
We did.
Yeah.
Linda and I, she just started to write. I was like, I just want to write like a big ballad, you know, Linda Perry special.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. And like, she sat at the piano and it was like 10 minutes. We wrote that song so fast.
I want to play it for people. The clip I'm going to play, you're performing Glorious on the NBC show The Voice. Let's listen.
I came home strong, knew what I was made of. I took on life, a bit untamed. But I could see a restless fire in his eyes, a love that never came.
That's my guest, Kate Hudson, singing the song Glorious, a live performance on the show The Voice. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Tanya Mosley, and this is Fresh Air.
Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, dedicated to offering viewers the opportunity to see it differently with British TV, streaming original series, Jane Austen dramas, Agatha Christie mysteries, and more at BritBox.com. And from Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley. My guest today is Kate Hudson. She's nominated for an Oscar for Best Actress for Song Sung Blue, where she plays one half of a real-life Neil Diamond tribute act in Milwaukee. It's her first nomination in 25 years and her first ever in a leading role. Over a career spanning more than two decades, she starred in films like Almost Famous, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, and Glass Onion. Her Netflix series Running Point has been picked up for a second season. In this half, we talk about Almost Famous and what it's like to carve out your own identity when your mother is Goldie Hawn, and more about her debut album Glorious from 2024. There's a song to your son, to your children.
Live Forever.
Live Forever.
Yeah.
Now that, I mean,
love that song.
The words of the song, I mean, it's I'm folding laundry crying, thinking about my kids. I mean, that is your love letter to your children.
Yeah, it really is. And I remember when Ronnie heard it, she's like, is that song for all of us? Because I wrote it really because Ryder was going to college, you know. And I was like, of course.
One of your children said.
Yeah, Ronnie, my little one, was like, is that for all of us? Like, what's my song? And I was like, it's for all of you guys, you know, but Ryder inspired it because he was leaving for college. And you think about your kids when they go, you're going to be doing this very soon.
Oh, my daughter went this year.
Oh, she went this year. Uh-huh. Oh, so you experienced it.
I experienced it. Yeah.
So when I wrote this song, Live Forever, he was leaving. Mm-hmm. He was about to leave. So the song kind of wrote itself. And I just kept thinking about how our children, they move on and you have to let them go. But the connection, whether we're here on this earth or whether we pass away, it's just that love is forever. Mm. And so every step of the way, you know, you are like, you know, I got you. Mm. Even when you let them go, you got them. You're here. You know, that idea of like, if you need me, I'm here.
You know, what's so interesting about you among so many things, Kate, is that we kind of have been following that road, both in your experience as a mother, but then also your experience with your mother, Goldie Hawn.
Yeah.
Watching that happen, your career blossom as a child of a famous actress, and then you grow and come of age, and then now you are in this position thinking about your kids. But I wanted to ask you, as it relates to the music side of you, you've called your music your Hudson side because your biological father is Bill Hudson. And he was a vocalist for the Hudson Brothers, which was a variety and rock act from the 1960s,
and guitar player.
70s.
And guitar. A guitar player.
Yeah.
Yeah. Guitar, piano, songwriter, singer.
You didn't grow up with him,
no.
though.
No.
Did you always know that your musical side came from him then? Were you aware of that as a child, loving music, that, hey, this might be from my dad's side?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Because my dad and I, we, you know, in the early years, you know, I got some pretty good experiences with my father. And, you know, he's a musician. So our whole understanding of dad was music. My sister is an amazing musician. My brother, Zach, great musician. My half siblings. My cousin, Sarah Hudson, amazing songwriter, writes a ton of big pop songs. Mm. And as a young girl, I grew up in my house and where I grew up with my mom and my stepdad, Kurt. I had a very different relationship to music than what the house offered, right? So, like, I didn't grow up in a house where, like, there was a ton of vinyl and we were, like, listening to, you know, a
records,
ton of different albums or records, you know, or who, you know, like how my kids grow up, where they're just exposed to so much music. Our house was, you know, filled with music, but in a different way.
Like,
so my discovery and my connection to music always felt different than like it came from somewhere else. So it was very early on. I knew very clearly it was my Hudson side.
Because they were just listening to music and you were like really into music.
Yeah. I mean, I had to write music. Like I'd sit in my room for hours and I'd like rewrite lyrics to other people's songs.
Who were the artists that
you
loved
the most? I'm a music fan. So it's not just one. I didn't have one inspiration growing up, but it would span anywhere from, I remember buying my first Ella Fitzgerald box set to Hank Williams box set to Jimi Hendrix to De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest, to Radiohead, to Belinda Carlisle, to the Go-Go's, to, I mean, it's all over, The Cure. Like, I was all over the place. I love music. You know, Pointer Sisters was a big one for me when I was little.
Who were you rewriting?
Everybody. Not because I wanted to rewrite their music, because I wanted to understand how to write music.
You were dissecting it.
Yeah. Phrasing is such an amazing thing to hear. And you hear all these great artists. And what's always separated sort of the great, like, folk writers or, you know, singer-songwriters was their love of lyrics. So like Nebraska, which I love, it's fun to have seen that movie this year, but Nebraska was such a great album because it's so lyrically heavy. You know, Bruce loves his lyrics, and I love writers that love lyrics. And so Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Bruce Springsteen, Taylor Swift, like very lyric-driven artists, storytellers. That's a very different kind of writing than pop music or R&B, you know? So I get into it. And so I would just sit, and I'd sit in my room, and I'd rewrite lyrics to understand what, like, a pop hook, like a lyrical hook, looks like.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kate Hudson, Oscar-nominated actress, singer, and entrepreneur. We're talking about her life, her family, and her most recent film, Song Sung Blue. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century.
This is Fresh Air, and today we're talking to Kate Hudson. Her new film, Song Sung Blue, has earned her an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress. It's her first Oscar nod since Almost Famous in 2001. She plays Claire Sardina, a real woman from Milwaukee who, alongside her husband Mike, built a life around their love of Neil Diamond's music. Kate, your breakout role for which you earned your first Oscar nomination and Golden Globe win was as Penny Lane in Almost Famous. And I actually want to play a scene from near the beginning of the film. So the young teen journalist, William, played by Patrick Fugit, is at the back door of a concert, and the guard is not letting him in. And a few young women, including your character, Penny Lane, come back to the back door and start talking to William.
Yeah,
let's listen.
Penny Lane, man, show some respect.
Who are you with? What band?
Oh, I'm here to interview Black Sabbath. I'm a journalist. I'm not a, you know.
You're not a what? You're not a what?
Not a groupie.
Aww. Groupie?
We are not groupies.
This is Penny Lane, man. Show some respect.
Groupies sleep with rock stars because they want to be near someone famous. We're here because of the music. We are Band-Aids.
She used to run a school for Band-Aids.
We don't have intercourse with these guys. We inspire the music. We're here because of the music.
You know, she was the one who changed everything. She was the one who said, no more sex. No more exploiting our bodies and our hearts.
Right, right.
Just and that's it.
That was my guest today, Kate Hudson, in Almost Famous. That is one of the most famous scenes because, of course, you really lay out who they are and what you do and what you don't
do. We are Band-Aids.
Right.
That's right. One of my favorite things, I did this show in San Diego, and you know, girls come and they like had these little signs that said, we're your Band-Aids. And it was so cute. I loved it so much. I was like, oh, it's so fun. Penny Lane, man.
I mean, you've said that you didn't have to reach very far to get to Penny Lane, which makes sense learning about you, even in this conversation. But what's a memory that you come back to the most in the filming of that iconic movie?
Oh, there's a million memories. I mean, there's no most.
the whole entire experience of making that film was, not only has it never repeated itself in terms of like experience and what that felt like, but it was so special for multiple reasons. Number one, Cameron Crowe is brilliant and an amazing person to work, amazing director to work for as an actor. Like, I couldn't have asked for, like, how lucky was I that I got to work with Cameron Crowe, like, so young on a role that was so layered. But it was his life story. Mm-hmm. So we were all, again, mm-hmm. like Song Sung Blue, there was this very, like, strong intention to get it right for Cameron. And everybody was in on it. We mm-hmm. all wanted to get it right for Cam. And so that made it very different. Then it was 6 months. It was a long shoot. We all got to know each other very well. We had rock school. Like, there was
Rock school?
Rock school was about a month before we started shooting. The band was learning how to play all the instruments, all the songs.
The fictitious band.
And the girls were band-aids, you know. We were hanging around and we'd, like, you know, get them food. And, like, you know, I was, like, bringing, you know, Billy, like, you know.
Billy Crudup.
We would just, like, hang, you know. We'd all, like, smoke and live in this alternate universe that we hadn't experienced yet.
Kind of like method acting, preparing rock school, preparing you for the real thing.
It's kind of what it was, yeah. And we were all so young and so fun. So, you know, we were having a great time together. And then the work was intense. You know, it was big set pieces, long days, big crew. So as much fun as we were having, then we... like anything else, like, it's a job and hard, great work.
Was there anything about that experience in particular, because I think about the fact that you were nominated for an Academy Award for your performance, that you then took with you for the rest of your career? Because what an experience to have that kind of was a lesson or a device or a thing that you took with you.
Preparation, again, I think focus. Cameron is a writer-director. His words are important to him, as they should be. And when you're young, you are learning kind of that sometimes a change of a word might not be the right word to change. So,
oh, did that happen?
Well, I mean, I think it happens a lot, you know, when you're working and you're, like, you know, in the middle of a scene and your brain might flub something and all of a sudden you're saying it in a different way or changing the way that the line works. When you're working with someone like Cameron, the way he writes is specific to his, you know, storytelling. And then the goal is making that seem effortless again, which can be challenging because Cameron's words are specific. Mm-hmm. And so when you get his words right, it's magic. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then you have a career and you realize sometimes what's on the page shouldn't be on the page. Mm-hmm. And you got to be able to decipher when you're working with the right person to do that with. And then maybe being a helpful collaborative partner and, you know, changing certain things around. So
this is so interesting because, you know, you then went on to become, I don't think it's overstating to say, almost like the rom-com queen. And you just played those roles really well. But you've also said that that genre has been dumbed down in a way that you wish that it would be elevated back up.
Oh, my God.
To a place.
It's been so dumbed down. I mean, anybody who – we all know it. The rom-com genre is a very hard genre to get right because people – like, they see one formula of a rom-com, and then they want to repeat it over and over
and over.
Right,
because it's like, that worked. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, right, that works.
Yeah, so let's repeat that. There is a specific formula, but I find that at the end of the day, the ones that have succeeded are the ones that are approached like they're going to be, like, a critically acclaimed film. Mm. The ones that are really good are good because they're good movies.
Yeah.
They hit all of
the notes that make you love what that movie is. And then the thing that happens that I notice in the business is that they box rom-coms into female comedies. So any female comedy is considered a rom-com. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with that. You know, Bride Wars isn't a rom-com. Bride Wars is a buddy comedy. That's a movie about two women, best friends, who are fighting over a wedding day. It has nothing to do with their romances.
And see, I put it in the rom-com category.
That's right.
Without even thinking.
And then everybody does. Mm-hmm. Fine. That's fine. But rom-com has become the female comedy. Mm-hmm. And
I don't think it
should be looked at like that. Rom-coms is men and women, or it's women and women if you want to make a rom-com about two women, or it's men and men if you want to make a rom-com about two men. It's about what is love. And you want it to feel light, and you want it to feel sad, and you want to feel all the feels, mm-hmm. right? So the best ones are things like As Good As It Gets, Sleepless in Seattle. You look at all of the best rom-coms, and they're two very intensely well-written male-female or female-female, male-male yeah. characters that are telling a story that we all relate to that's incredibly human. Hmm. So we need to invest in those. That's what that genre is.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kate Hudson, Oscar-nominated actress, singer, and entrepreneur. We're talking about her life, her family, and her most recent film, Song Sung Blue. We'll be right back after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and today we're talking to Kate Hudson. Her new film, Song Sung Blue, has earned her an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress. You and your mother, Goldie Hawn, you're known for your exceptionally close relationship. But what's it like building a career? Was there ever any tension about building a career following your mother? Like, did you ever have a moment of rebellion when you felt like maybe I want to be or do something else?
As a
young person.
Oh, honestly, there was nothing else to me. I don't know. That had nothing to do with like performing. But when I say nothing else, I mean performance. So like singing, dance, song, dance, acting, like those three things were just like, that's what I do. Like from very early on, if someone was like, you'd be a very good lawyer, I'd be like, in a movie.
You just always knew. Yeah.
I always knew. Yeah. And then when you grow up in a house with parents who are not only incredible performers, but like amazing producer. My mother's an amazing producer, trailblazing producer. My dad is one of the great process of an actor I've ever witnessed.
Kurt Russell.
Yep, Kurt Russell. Let's just call him Kurt Russell because it's a fun name to say. I have a friend who only calls him Kurt Russell. It's really funny. No, I call him Pa.
Yeah.
He's my Pa. But his process and what I learned from my dad growing up, I mean, he's got an incredible process, a very caring process when it comes to storytelling. So when you grow up like that, and it says something that there's only one of us who's not an actor. You know, my other two brothers are actors. They're also very much into storytelling, developing, writing, producing, like that comes from what we were modeled as kids, which was people who really care about telling stories. That's so when you see that and you're like, oh, so fun. I mean, we were just kids making movies our whole life. So
I just wonder how it is to reflect now. You're an accomplished actor and a multitude of other things. There's a generation that knows you, and they don't even know your mom or your dad.
I know.
And so for you to come up during this, you know, with this person who is so well known as your mother, you all also look just alike. You know, you look so similar, to now being at a place where we could have had this entire conversation and I never talked about your mom. You know what I mean? Like, was there ever a moment of growing where you could see a future where that would be the case? And was that ever tension for you, having a having such well-known parents and then stepping into a career like this?
I never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
I think because we all love each other, like, we so much. It's such a strong unit. Our family is really a strong unit. Outside of the business, you know what I mean? Like, just as like a family, it's so strong that I've never thought of it from that way, you know? The only thing for me that was really important was that I really wanted it on my own terms. So, and I see my son feeling similarly right now. There's a lot of opportunities that come. I think that there is a responsibility to say opportunity does come when you grow up in Los Angeles. You got a lot of privileged kids who work in this industry, who have a lot of parents with a lot of power and a lot of access. So it's like to say that there's not opportunity is to be lying. And but there's something else that comes with it when you grow up in it, which is, you also, as an actor, as a performer, you have to be, you have to honor the craft and be good enough to have other people actually want to watch you. So that part requires like a different type of
fortitude. Yeah.
Right. It's like going into it. It was like, okay, I just want to do this on my own terms. I know that when I walk in the room, everyone's going to know, or maybe some of them, maybe they won't. I have a different last name, thank God. I was so happy about that when I was younger, to not have to walk in the room and be a Russell or a Han.
Yep.
It was nice to sort of not have that be something where, you know, people went, oh. So that the pressure wasn't, didn't feel as intense, right? But you know, when they do know, that you have to be on your game, you know? You can't, like, walk in and not know your lines, or you can't, you know, which is why I worked so disciplined in everything else that I did. Like, I just wanted to do a good job. And, you know, when you grow up with parents like that, like, there's so much modeling that they did that I take with me, right? Like, right now, I look at this Oscar nomination, and I look at my mother, and it's an absolute extension of my mother. I think people who didn't grow up with a parent in the industry still feel like these moments are extensions of their parents and the gifts that they give. But I have a mom that sees all of that differently. She knows what it is. She knows what it feels like. She knows the work that goes into it, the time away from your kids that it takes. She knows how deeply I miss my kids when I'm doing these things. She knows all of it, right? And she knows that I know that that's what she went through. So there's this amazing connection that I get to have with my mom at this time. She's 80, I'm 46. Like, how lucky am I that I get to really share that experience with her in that way? I feel very, very blessed to, like, have my mom and Kurt be the people that, like, really
are behind you and set the model for you. Kate Hudson, it's been a pleasure to learn more about you and to have this conversation.
Thank you. This is so nice.
Kate Hudson is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress for her role in the film Song Sung Blue.
Thank you.
Fresh Air, novelist Tayari Jones, on her new book, Kin, a story of two motherless girls in 1950s Louisiana whose friendship becomes the most powerful bond of their lives. Jones talks about writing through illness, the loss that inspired this novel, and what it means to choose your own kin. I hope you can join us. To keep up with what's on the show and get highlights of our interviews, follow us on Instagram at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Sam Brigger. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Monique Nazareth, Thea Challoner, Susan Yakundi, Anna Bauman, and Nico Gonzalez-Whistler. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Schorock directs the show. With Terry Gross, I'm Tanya Mosley.
NPR comes from this station. And from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, for 35 years sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.